For the week of January 11th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 264, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Charlie Hebdo.
Wait a second. Now, please don't make the same mistake that 90% of the news media made last week, which was actually trying to pronounce the H.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Charlie Hebdo.
Charlie Hebdo. Yes.
Okay. I wasn't pronouncing it as a French person.
Now,
but I didn't say je suis Charlie Hebdo.
Right.
I said I am Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah, right. Now, I would like to actually, since I just
tried. How do you know how Charlie Hebdo is pronounced?
I was listening to the actual French media pronounce it.
Mon Dieu.
And for all of those French men and French women who would like to write in and tell me what a poor job I did, they can do so by writing to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T @showbizsandbox.com. Or better yet, you know what you could do? Call us, leave us a voicemail with the proper pronunciation, and we'll play it on next week's show. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Those are all the ways to call and tell me what a bad job I did with my French pronunciation.
And what will all our French listeners be hearing about on this week's show?
Well, on this week's show, we're going to commence with the annual slog, commonly referred to, and this is industry parlance, okay, so you'll have to excuse us, it's known as award season.
Didn't we already start award season weeks ago?
We did, but now it's beginning really in earnest, I think. Don't you think? The BAFTA nominations were announced last week. Though apparently, by the way, Michael, they weren't very British at all. There was nothing British about them. And just last evening, the 72nd annual Golden Globes were held in Beverly Hills, or as we like to call them, Academy Award auditions. It seems like it would be a crime if we did not bring up and update you on the latest news concerning the cyber attack against Sony Pictures, including a bit about Charlize Theron. Did you see what I did there with the word crime, Michael? Did you?
No, I didn't. What?
It would be.
Keep going.
My jokes are lost even on me. Well, we'll also be touching on some news relating to how artists are bringing their work directly to fans. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world, not just in North America. We pull our information from Rentrack, and you'll find a link to their website in our show notes. We also get info from The Hollywood Reporter, The Los Angeles Times, Variety, you name it. And the number one movie around the world has a particular set of skills, and it is called Taken 3. The Liam Neeson film grossed $81 million over the weekend. It must have opened on a Wednesday somewhere because it's at $92 million worldwide.
You know what I was thinking about this film upon seeing it was that actually if Liam Neeson from Taken, the Taken franchise, and Denzel Washington from The Equalizer, if they got together, they could like clear out all the bad guys in Eastern Europe.
Or anywhere around the world.
Right. True. But, they happen to be fighting a lot of Eastern Europeans, I suppose.
Hand-to-hand combat may not be the best way to deal with structural problems in Eastern Europe.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
At number two around the world is Night at the Museum 3. That grossed $52 million worldwide, and the movie's at $250 million and counting. That's doing pretty poorly in North America, and they're hoping to make that up overseas. At number three around the world is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, another $30 million, $780 million worldwide as it cruises past $800 million and tries to be the final Hobbit-like film to reach $1 billion worldwide. I'm not sure if they'll do it, but do they have China next, or do they have any countries left? I'm not sure,
yeah. I mean, I think it already opened in China.
That's always a struggle for us because we don't have a listing of what countries it's opened in and what are to come. So that's always a problem when we're trying to predict where a movie will end up. We sort of just have to wait 6 months and see what happens. And number four is Into the Woods, another $17 million, which is very similar to the movie at number eight, Unbroken, which grossed $14 million worldwide. Into the Woods is at $120 million. Unbroken is at $115 million and counting. Most of that has been made in North America and in the North American box office. It's kind of bizarre. These two movies have opened up and they've been like arm in arm. They're making literally the same amount of money. It's like, I feel like this family musical and this drama about World War II, and yet somehow they are absolutely, they're like identical twins at the box office.
Now, you asked about The Hobbit and China. That film, The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, opens January 23rd in China.
Ah, there you go. I thought I had a big territory left, at least one. So you can imagine it might make, you know, $80, $100 million in China. So we'll have to see where that ends up. But that will certainly give it a big boost towards getting to $1 billion worldwide. And it's true. The studios only pull back 25%, but that's not much less than other territories where they only get 30 or 35%. Clearly, they want more, and they should get more, and they should negotiate more strongly.
Well,
but,
you know,
that's not pennies. $25 million in the till is better than nothing.
Well, 25% of a whole lot of money is a lot more than 100% of none.
That's true. But you're going to have to stick to none once or twice in order to get a higher rate. You have to say, look, I'm not giving you my movie.
Right.
You know, you have to stay firm somehow. That's the only way to do it. But I'm intrigued by how Into the Woods and Unbroken, they're both potential Oscar nominees. They're both doing very well commercially. I mean, Into the Woods is at $105 million in North America, almost obviously not adjusting for inflation, not counting animated films, which are musicals in every sense of the word, but looking at live action musicals in the modern era, like virtually none of them have ever grossed $100 million. There's only 8 or 9 movies, and that includes Grease and Chicago and Dreamgirls. I mean, it's very rare for a musical to gross that much money, and that's where Into the Woods is, and it's not even done yet.
So what you're saying is, to gross more than $100 million as a musical, you should cast every giant movie star you can find.
Well, I don't think that's a star-heavy movie particularly.
Into the Woods?
I think Meryl Streep is a big star, but look at The Baker. I mean, James Corden's not a big star. There's a lot of people in that movie that are not. I mean, Chris Pine is a star, but he's not a guaranteed, you know, outside of the Star Trek movies, he's not exactly, a lock.
Johnny Depp?
Johnny Depp is in a smaller role, but absolutely, he's a big star. But Anna Kendrick, she's the lead. James Corden's the lead. Those are not people that are, you know, unbelievable blockbuster big names. Right.
Okay. Well,
Emily Blunt, you know, Tammy Blanchard, Tracy Ullman. These are talented, wonderful people, but they're not, you know, filling the box office till. But yeah, you've got Meryl Streep, and you've got in a smaller role, you've got Johnny Depp. That's great. That's smart. But it's not a top heavy all star. Every single name is a huge, huge Tom Cruise. It's not like The Expendables.
Okay.
Don't you agree?
Yeah, it's probably. Yes, you're right. It's not like The Expendables.
Okay. All right. At number 6 around the world. No, I'm looking at North American box office. Forgive me, everybody. At number 5 around the world is Exodus, Gods and Kings. That's the Christian Bale film. Another $16 million. That's at $230 million worldwide. It has a fair number of territories to go, but this is looking like it will be a disappointment. But a hit is probably what you can say is Miss Granny. This is a South Korean comedy. It grossed $50 million in its opening weekend. It's a hilarious film about an old woman who feels like she's becoming a burden on her family, and suddenly, magically, I don't know how, but Miss Granny turns back into her 20-year-old self. So suddenly she's a young, vibrant woman again. So it's kind of like Big for senior citizens. Instead of a kid who wants to be an adult, it's an adult who gets to go back to being a young woman again.
Now, wait a second. Wasn't there another Korean movie like this?
There was something out there, yes. But this is where we're at right now with it. There was something somewhat similar, and I can't remember now what it is. But yeah, I almost thought it had been re-released or was the latest part of it, you know, it jumped back in the box office. But no, this is opening weekend, so that's what this is. And number 7 is Big Hero 6, $14 million. It's at $400 million worldwide, trying to get to $500 million so it can say, yes, we are a solid success. It's clearly not a failure, not a fall-on-your-face failure, but given the reviews and given the potential, it's an expensive movie, so they probably would have liked it to be a little bit stronger. At number 9 is The Imitation Game, another $13 million. Just like I link Unbroken and Into the Woods, in my mind, I'm always linking The Imitation Game and The Theory of Everything. The Imitation Game is about Alan Turing. The Theory of Everything is about Stephen Hawking. They're both sort of British-based movies. They're in my mind together. And Imitation Game is the one that's really coming out on top. Though, of course, Eddie Redmayne just won the Golden Globe for Best Actor.
Yes, which I was a little surprised.
Well, it's the Globes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And number 10 is Selma, which finally opened wide here in North America and a very strong beginning to its wide release campaign. You know, had very good reviews in limited release, very good box office, and now it's grossed $11 million around the country, a very good start to its campaign. This is a classic film that will have legs. And even though they didn't get screeners out and it wasn't on the, you know, it wasn't didn't gain any traction from SAG or from the Golden Globes, this movie and American Sniper, I think, are going to be among the mix of movies for Best Picture come Oscar time. And American Sniper is still in limited release, but it is tearing it up. People are ready to see this movie. I mean, it is really jam-packed in its limited release. I think it's on four screens or something still. So I think it opens wide next weekend. And because I think I just saw a TV ad, and that's going to do very well as well.
By the way, Miss Granny, okay, that is the film we're thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know how it came back.
Well, it didn't come back. It's opening weekend. Its total box office is $18.5 million. You'll have to figure that out. Worldwide box office sometimes is a bit of a mystery to us. Like, look at Ode to My Father.
Actually, it opened January 22nd, 2014. So what? That's a year ago. So
you're saying this is a reissue?
It must be. If it's making that much money again, right?
Maybe it's Miss Granny too. Maybe the box office numbers were maybe the box office title was not complete.
Maybe. We'll have to find out.
Well, thank you for confusing everything. Yeah, you're right. Miss Granny was 2014, but that was what was on Rentrack. Maybe it's Miss Granny too. Yoon Hyung Shim. Let's see if she's got. I don't see a Miss Granny too. Well, we've confused everybody. Thank you, South Korea. Come let us know what's going on there. Another big hit in South Korea, which is a fertile. And again, Miss Granny sounds like it should be remade, right?
It does. I can't imagine it won't be.
Right. You've got Ode to My Father, which is also tearing it up at the South Korean box office. That's that multi-decade saga that tells the story of South Korea through the eyes of one family, and especially the son who is trying to take the place of his father who has disappeared when they got separated during war. That grossed another $10 million. It's at $65 million and counting just from that one territory. And Paddington is doing okay. It's at $120 million worldwide. Still hasn't opened up in North America. Annie is down in the box office. That's about to pass $100 million worldwide, and $80 million of that came in the U.S. It's already one of the, I think, 12 or 14 biggest grossing musicals of all time, and that clearly is not adjusting for inflation and not including animated movies, because those are Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Little Mermaid. Those are musicals. You know, there's no reason why you shouldn't include them, but they're not. And finally, down at number 18 is one other new movie that's worth mentioning. It's Honig im Kopf. I'm sure I'm wildly mispronouncing that. It's a German drama. It's now made $30 million in Germany and one other territory. It made $5 million this weekend. It was co-written, directed, and stars Till Schweiger, who's the actor from Inglourious Basterds. And it's the story of a little girl played by his real-life daughter, Emma, who takes her grandfather on one last adventure before Alzheimer's dooms him to a nursing facility. It opened on Christmas Day. I'm sure tears flow by the end of the film.
Well, you know, a couple weeks ago, we talked about this film, PK, which was an Indian film.
That's right.
A film from India that actually came in the top 10 here in the United States when it opened not only in India, but here in North America as well.
That's right. That's the movie about an alien who comes down to Earth and he has to get clothes and he finds romance in the big city and he exposes some fraudulent sort of televangelist type figures.
Right. Well, it is now the highest grossing film ever in India.
Is that in Indian language or any film?
Well, I don't know. The Financial Express says it is the highest grossing film of all time in India, collecting $49 million or 3.05 billion rupees.
Only $50 million, and that makes it the highest grossing movie of all time in a country with 1 billion people. That is a country where studio execs go, man, I can't wait to get more screens in that country.
Well, a couple of issues there, or a couple
Ticket
points.
Ticket prices are very low.
That's number one. And the country originally, you know, traditionally has been underscreened. So it's 1.4 sure. billion people population.
And they have seven screens.
Right, exactly.
Right. And of course, while it's a country is making leaps and bounds into prosperity, just like China. I mean, China has a massive middle class of hundreds of millions of people. They also have hundreds of millions of people who are living on subsistence living. So they're not really moviegoers. They're, you know, worried more about their daily bread. And India, while it's making leaps and bounds, certainly has a significant portion of that billion people that is also not ready to become, you know, casual middle class moviegoing public.
No.
Well, I don't know if PK is eligible for the BAFTA Awards, but I think it probably came out too late, but the BAFTA nominations were announced. And why do we care about the BAFTA, Sperling? These, of course, are the British Academy Awards. It's condescending of us to compare everything to the Academy Awards, but that's what we do, right? We're like, it's the British Academy Awards.
You know,
it's the French Academy Awards. But so what?
Well, I think a part of it is a couple points. One, the Academy Awards honoring film and motion pictures were first, and I'm sure somebody's
rarely gonna, for something from America.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody's going to correct me about that. And the American
Lumieres were there before.
Yeah. And you know, American films seem to dominate the marketplace so much so that when they get awarded, it's, you know, awarding this big dominant cultural.
But why do we care about the BAFTAs?
Well,
not that we're not interested in awards all over the world. I'd love to hear what the South Korean award winners are every year. But well, BAFTAs especially have had a really good track record lately, haven't they?
That's right. Now, you know, you said something there. I just want to backtrack just a bit. You said that, you know, it's condescending. And I agree. I always feel like, well, why are the Academy Awards so darn important? Why don't we say the Césars or the BAFTAs or some other awards? But I noticed that in Cannes and other film festivals, they always mention the Oscar first. You know,
oh, yeah.
John, you could have won 17 César Awards. But
you got an Oscar.
But yeah. You got an Oscar, and that's what everybody will talk about.
That's true. And so the BAFTAs have named the Oscar winner for Best Picture 5 years in a row now. So they
are
on a hot streak as far as predicting Academy Awards. They're doing better than the Golden Globes. They're clearly seeing themselves as sort of an Oscar predictor, because if you look at their list of best film nominees, for any movie worldwide, it looks like they're trying to do a shortlist for the Academy Awards.
Yes. I mean, normally there's a few films in that best film category that are more British. Yeah. That kind of, they're not going to make the best picture Oscars or be in the Césars, but they make best film at the BAFTAs.
And what are the nominees this year for best film, since these are their predictions of what will be one of the winners for the Academy Awards?
That pause is me waiting for the pre-reading of the nominees. Like,
oh, and the nominees are?
Yeah, exactly.
Birdman.
Birdman, Alejandro G. Iñárritu.
Oh, don't read.
Okay.
No.
Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, Wes Anderson's film, The Imitation Game, and The Theory of Everything.
Well, and those, of course, are British British-centric movies.
Yes, those two last ones, yes.
Yes, so, you know, they do have British movies in the mix there, though I don't know if they were made in England, were they, or are they studio pictures? I'm not sure.
I think they were made in England.
But since Boyhood won the Golden Globe for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actress, that clearly, again, it feels like an underdog no matter what, but it's going to remain the underdog right until it wins Best Picture at the Academy Awards.
You're saying Boyhood?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think people are kind of coming to terms with, hey, it took 12 years to make this thing. It's never going to be repeated.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, look at the 7-Up series.
Good
point.
That's
a film series that's ongoing, and it's a remarkable, if you've never watched it or dove in, start with 7-Up and go to 14-Up and 21-Up. It's a great documentary series following a group of British school children from the age of 7, and then they revisit them every 7 years. It's a masterpiece.
Yeah, I mean, it basically takes its hypothesis from the saying, show me a boy at 7 and I'll show you the man. And they basically try and prove that theory out or wind up documenting that theory.
And they do have a special category for outstanding British film at the BAFTAs. And this is the only other category I think we'll mention. But they list movies like 71, The Imitation Game, Paddington, Pride, which is a gay rights film. I'm not sure that it's British, but I guess it was made by British. The Theory of Everything and Under the Skin, which I'm looking forward to seeing. But 71 stood out for me there because I saw it at the New York Film Festival, and it stars Jack O'Connell, who also stars in Unbroken, and he's terrific in 71. And he's good in Unbroken, even though I don't think it's a good film. But 71 is a good movie. It's a good calling card for the director and certainly for Jack O'Connell, and he's very good in it. So he's definitely a talent to watch.
Now, let me ask, I guess maybe I could answer my own question by scrolling. No, I can't. Whether the Grand Budapest Hotel, whether that was an adaptation or not.
No, that's an original script, I believe.
Okay, because really, if you look at screenplay, okay.
We're still stuck in the BAFTAs?
We're still stuck in the BAFTAs, but if you look at screenplay, okay, and I just mean the award season in general, this year, you could give...
Well, it was inspired by the writings of Stefan Zweig. I should not say that. So it's not... It would be an adaptation because I read a book by Stefan Zweig. What book did I read? I mean, he wrote The Grand Budapest Hotel and Letters from an Unknown Woman, you know, movies that were inspired by these books that he wrote. He's certainly a writer whose name I've read. Journey into the Past, I think that was one of his books that I've read. So, you know, it is based on the work by Stefan Zweig, who's Viennese, basically. I mean, I don't know what empire it was at the time. It might have been the Austro-Hungarian Empire or something like that. But he's Viennese, to keep it simple.
Well, I mean, if you could put that script in the adaptation category.
Which it should be, I believe, I think.
And Birdman in original, then you could award Grand Budapest Hotel. You could award Birdman and Inuyasha. And then you could give Best Director to Richard Linklater and Best Picture to Richard and to Boyhood. And you've kind of like spread the love around by saying, yes, Birdman.
If those
was fantastic,
are the three films you think should have it.
I'm actually playing the long game by saying, you know, here's how things might stack up when people go and fill
out
their ballots.
That's your
prediction. I'd have to actually see the nominations, which will be announced this Thursday.
Yeah, people do not sit there. I don't think that's how we always think about it, but I don't think it's that thought out. I think it's just emotional and quick, and they go, they don't say, well, let me give this to this and this, that, because a lot of times movies sweep. So, you know, the idea that 1 year they're going to let a movie sweep and the next year you say, well, let me divvy it out and be generous to everybody. It doesn't work that way.
No, but there is the theory that when Denzel Washington doesn't win for X film in year one, that in year two, when he gets nominated.
That's true. But what's that got to do with the Birdman and Grand Budapest Hotel?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, absolutely nothing.
Okay, thank you. So moving on to the Golden Globes.
Yes, which I know you didn't watch because you actually have your, you know, I only watch the big four.
Well, life is too short.
That's true. And that's why I did watch it and I watched it on Fast Forward.
Was it unfunny? I mean, my friend said that the opening of Tina Fey and Amy, he was just like, this isn't even remotely funny.
There were a few chuckles, but then they hit the Bill Cosby joke. And whoever thought it was a good idea to make those jokes should never work on an award show again.
Why? Worked for Ricky Gervais to cross the line and be edgy?
Yes.
It worked for the Oscars when they had, what's his name, Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane, and people didn't like it, but it got attention.
It got attention.
And the next day, there's the headlines.
Yeah, and he never hosted again, I might add.
Well, only once. Most people don't host more than once. Was it funny?
No.
Well, that's all that matters. If it's not funny, you're saying you're offended or it just wasn't funny?
It just was. That part was not funny at all. And
why couldn't you not make a joke about Bill Cosby?
Is he
untouchable? Too soon? It's been decades. He's been raping women for decades, allegedly. And they've been talking about it and claiming it and speaking out about it. And big stories have been written about it for decades. So why is it suddenly he's paid out money to people because they accused him of rape? And he agreed never to claim that they just did it, you know, shook him down for money. That's happened many years ago. So why is it too soon?
It's not that it's too soon. It's in poor taste.
Why is it? Well, I thought raping women was in poor taste.
It is. And you know what? Doesn't necessarily belong on an award show. That's
didn't quite set the right tone.
Correct. That's probably the best.
But if it had been funny, you wouldn't have cared. Anything can be made funny.
And if it had been done with a little bit of taste, yes.
Well, there's no taste to be had in a joke about rape. It's either funny or it's not. It may be tasteless, but funny. Springtime for Hitler is tasteless, but funny.
Correct.
Yeah. What do you mean correct? You were just saying the opposite.
I think we're vehemently agreeing with one another.
Only if you changed your mind. So the Golden Globes happened. The show was okay. It's typical Golden Globes. They named movies. They will or will not predict the Oscars. Nobody cares because tomorrow the Oscar nominations will come out and that's all we'll talk about and care about. So it's really the end of the award season. All that matters is the Oscar nominations and we're about to find them out.
Right. And quite honestly, I think the Golden Globes are picked by like 99 or 90.
I think 87 or 82.
They keep dropping. Yeah.
People die.
Yeah, well, yeah. They don't replace them, I guess. I don't know.
I always think I'm from Bermuda. I probably can and should be able to get a membership in the Golden Globes as a Bermuda entertainment reporter.
Yeah, well, it's very rare that when they trot the president of the HFPA, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, that's usually the time people are kind of like not paying attention or...
It's saying that for every award show, when they rule out the welcome to the Grammys, we're doing important work in schools, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Well, you know, in this case, the gentleman whose name, unfortunately, I forget, he's a critic, I believe, from Denmark or Holland. He got a standing ovation for what he said about, we stand for free speech. And it was a rousing speech and it was very short.
And people have, you know, this is a... people have worn, I am Charlie's Just Sweet Charlie buttons. I know George Clooney did, and Jared Leto and others. You know, it was nice. The march in Paris was stirring. I mean, more than a million people. It was kind of a beautiful thing to see.
Although,
people speaking up and saying, we don't care how offensive that thing is. We are happy to support free speech because that's what a civilized society does. And we cannot allow fear to overwhelm us. And the head of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is Theo Kingma.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
You're welcome.
Just a small aside before we get back to the Golden Globes for just a moment.
We never left.
Okay. You know what really bothered me about all the news coverage about the protests in Paris over the weekend?
I didn't watch any of it. What did?
That all the media could talk about was how there was no U.S. representation. Obama didn't show up.
There was the Attorney General, wasn't there?
I believe so, yes.
How is that not?
But I just thought, you know what, guys? There's already enough drama going on there. There's already enough security issues going on there. Do you know what it's like to have somebody like President Obama come to your city or town? It's not... It's nerve-wracking, and it messes things up. And
well, they had 40 leaders. I mean, they had 40 countries were represented, right? So they're just saying, hey, maybe the U.S. should have been there. But they had a person there. It wasn't the vice president. It was the attorney general. Whether it should have been someone higher up or Obama, I'm sure that would have been fine. But I don't feel like the U.S. was sliding it. It would, you know, felt like somewhat of a European rally. Why steal away the thunder? Would have been great if they'd gone somebody higher up. But we had a representative there. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Anyway.
Yeah. They're trying to create, you know, tension and annoy. Oh, like the U.S. doesn't care. You know, the U.S. is having some conference where they're going to talk to people about what works in engaging communities and trying to, you know, stop recruitment from being effective. Isn't that a lot of fun? Here we are weighing in on world events.
Exactly.
But Golden Globes, movie stuff, I don't really care about, but they do have a pretty good track record on television, oddly enough. It always feels kind of like an afterthought at the Golden Globes, but they're pretty good at naming young new shows and young new talent and giving them a spotlight. They did it with Party of Five, I remember way back when, and ever since then, they've been pretty good about TV and what they highlight and what happened this year.
Well, this year, they were very transparent in who they picked. See what I did there? Since they picked transparent.
Keep going. Yes.
Okay. You know, I need a laugh track. That's what I...
No, you don't.
Oh, brother. So they picked Transparent, which is the transgender show, as best... what was it? Best comedy that they picked? And this is a show that is on Amazon. Can't even be seen on television. Well, I guess it can be seen on television, but...
Of course it can. Yes, that's the whole point. and Jeffrey Tambor won Best Actor. So it's the first show from Amazon to win a major award, I think, right?
Yes.
Right. So, I mean, Netflix had their day. Now Amazon's stepping it up. You know, so that's exciting. So that's big news because it's Amazon. Big news because of the type of show it is. And The Affair won Best Drama. That was sort of an upset.
Yes, I was shocked.
Showtime series, right?
Yeah, Showtime series. Although The Affair also won... The girl from it, the lead actress.
Lead actress, the girl.
The girl.
You are so Hollywood.
You know.
Ruth Wilson?
Yes. She gave a very awkward speech. She won for Best Actress.
Well, here's my thought. The Golden Globes has a long history of doing a pretty good job with TV, but to me, it always gets sort of lost in the shuffle because it comes out at the wrong time of the year.
Right.
It's overshadowed by the movie stuff. They're trying to piggyback on the Oscars. Split them in two. Do a Golden Globes now for the Oscars. Do another Golden Globes 6 months later, right before the Emmys. Piggyback on that. You know what? Suddenly you got two award shows instead of one. It's all about making money. That's all the only reason they do it. You get two TV shows instead of one. You get to pretend to influence the Emmys, just like you get to pretend you influence the Oscars. People will be more focused and excited by it because they're trying to influence Emmy voters. And you get, you know, double the money.
Yeah, but what do you call those? The Golden Globes?
The Golden
Globes
Television Awards. The Golden Globes Movie Awards. What do you mean?
Okay.
Golden Globes.
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard enough to put them on once.
Not hard. It's when they make most of their money for the year.
That's true.
Money-making venture. It's not hard. It's a joy and a pleasure.
Well,
they
apparently,
get tens of millions of dollars.
Apparently, they had no clue who was going to win these awards because Gina Rodriguez, who won for a lead actress in a TV comedy or musical. Called Jane the Virgin. She was so far in the back, it took like 5 minutes for her to get up there.
That shows that they don't know who's going to win. That's appropriate. But again, all the more appropriate if you don't have movies and TV and have to decide who gets to be up front in movies versus TV, right? Because that's, you know, she wasn't the big name. She was sort of an upset. That means all the TV people would be up front. And it's another chance to have a party, make a lot of money, get more attention for the TV shows that you're highlighting. Where's the loss? Why not do it? You don't think that's a good idea? I think it's a great idea.
I think you should. What's their phone number? Let me give you the HFPA. Have you ever dealt with the HFPA?
I have not.
Okay. Yeah. You try dealing with them more than once a year.
Well, hey guys, want to double your money?
Okay, that might be a good selling point. I don't know. I thought,
we're done.
We're done. Yeah, because frankly, it's really just about like 90 people picking these winners.
That's the Oscars, only a couple hundred people or a thousand.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's 7, always 000, a limited group of people.
But what I will say is, you know, I don't find them to be very good predictors necessarily of Oscar nominations or victories. But what I will say is that they can lose you the Oscar. And I think that, God, who was the wrestler? Mickey Rourke. When he gave his speech he won for the wrestler and he gave
it was ungracious or it was tacky or yeah, it was
boring. The whole thing just didn't like feel right. And that was the end of him for that year. He just kind of slid downhill. He was nominated and everything.
That's possible, though. That's kind of sad if people only, you know, he doesn't give a good speech. To hell with him. Never mind that it was a groundbreaking performance that moved me to tears.
Right. Well,
you know,
Michael Keaton, however, on the other hand, sounded like he was running for president. He started with, my name was Michael Douglas, and it started in, I guess I didn't know that his original name was Michael.
Did you like his speech?
Yes, I did. I think he kind of lost it halfway through where he kind of was a little, I don't want to say nervous, but he kind of, I guess it hit him where he was and what was going on. I don't know, but he actually was
Golden Globes.
Very heartfelt speech.
Nice.
And
you think it helped him?
I think it really helped him. I will say it must have been 9,000 degrees in that room. Everybody was sweating. Everybody.
Jane Fonda's boyfriend passed out.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Right before she went on stage, he passed out and they had called the paramedics and they checked him out. He was fine. So he didn't need medical attention. But yeah, he passed out from the hot lights.
Yeah, and everybody was, you know, fanning themselves with whatever they could find, and then people would get up there, and you'd see them get up there, they weren't sweating, and by the time they were off stage, it looked like they had run a marathon. And Kevin Spacey gave a great speech as well.
And there you go.
Yeah, I mean, and so, that you know, he won for House of Cards, so there's another, that's Netflix, so another streaming series, I guess. I don't know what we call
those
that.
Those are
web
the hot
series?
Shows of the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, so that's
you know
cool.
what? Close. I've got an even better idea for you.
What, better than mine of splitting them in two and doubling your money?
Absolutely. Do the Golden Globes Movie Awards, the Golden Globes Television Awards.
No.
How would you like to triple your money?
No. TV shows are TV. We don't care where and how you see the movie. We don't care where and how you see the TV show. It's just a show that you watch on your TV or your phone or your tablet. But no, we don't care where it originates from. We just care how good, what country it's from, or you know how you streamed it or how you watched it. We just want to know if it's a good movie or a bad movie. Same thing with television. There's no reason. You only have them split up when you're trying to bring attention to a genre that's ignored. When the Emmys wouldn't give cable shows an award, that's when you had the Cable Ace Awards. And then when they started winning Emmys, then they got rid of the Cable Aces because they weren't necessary anymore.
That's true.
Yeah. So what's the latest with the Sony hack? Oh, I shouldn't say that. Damn it. What's the latest with the Sony cyber attack?
Well, you know, let me call North Korea and find out. And
maybe you shouldn't.
That's true. Oh, very good. That was very quick of you. I don't think I would have been that quick today. I mean, we're already tangential today, but I don't think I would have gotten that. The reason you're saying that, Michael, is because there are all of these people. And we kind of mentioned this last week.
Yeah, in depth we mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah, that there are some security experts, some cybersecurity experts saying, you know, guys, you haven't made a really convincing case that this was North Korea, as opposed to somebody that was just kind of pretending to be North Korea because they didn't want you to catch them.
And the FBI doubled down and gave some more new information to try and back up what they've been saying without releasing any classified details.
Right, which is very difficult to do because as it is, these types of cyber attacks are very difficult to attribute.
So what the FBI said was they made some, you know, major snafus that they tried to cover up and they weren't able to do it. And that's how we know it's them. He say the cyber attackers made a critical error. This is according to senior government officials describing what FBI analysts saw, telling it to the New York Times and others. They said the cyber attackers made a big error by logging into both their Facebook account and Sony's servers from North Korean internet addresses. It was clear they knew they made a mistake because they immediately tried to log out and log in, do other stuff, but they'd already messed up. And so there was clear footprints of to who it was. And they gave other examples of that, didn't they? I mean, other examples of information that they had that makes them say, no, we know it's North Korea.
Oh, what, everything was pinging back to an IP address in North Korea?
others, everything. They talked for a while and said, no. They know they got a problem, and they've stepped it up and said, no. We know it's them. Here's some vague reasons why. Are people convinced?
I don't think anybody's ever convinced about these attacks, which is why they're so effective at times.
What? No, are security experts convinced by what the FBI said? Are they convinced that the FBI has more information, that they are very confident, and they do in fact know that it was North Korean cyber attackers?
No, I don't think so. Do you?
Not necessarily. Though I keep going back to the idea, well, why would they blow it up into a big international incident, this being the Obama administration, if they didn't have to? They don't need more problems on their plate. And if it's not clear it was North Korea, why the heck would they want to say it was? I can see if you make a mistake, maybe you're too embarrassed and you want to double down because you're afraid of being, you look dumb. And maybe Obama doesn't realize that there are serious issues about this. Now he will. But, when they came to him and said, oh, no, it's North Korea, I'm sure he took them at their word. He didn't know to say, well, what about the IP? We learn on the go when these things happen about what the experts look for and things that they do. So, that's how you become that's how you learn on the job. So the FBI people may have messed up and then they're afraid to back down. But this is them clearly saying, no, we know, but I don't think people are convinced yet. I think they got to bring some people in and, give them a security clearance and say, no, look, here's more information that we have. Show them the stuff so those people can go back to the world and say, oh, no, they've got it. They've got it. Because I think they have a real problem.
Yeah, well, it's a problem, but I think it's also one that's kind of fading, don't you?
No, they're putting new penalties against North Korea because of the attacks.
New sanctions.
We
did get a couple of emails last week that from listeners who said, well, why would, and they used the word you used, Michael, one that I kind of thought was an interesting turn of phrase. He said, why would they want to gin up a whole controversy with North Korea? And a lot of international listeners said, oh, yeah, gee, why would anybody ever say that there were weapons of mass destruction in a foreign country that we need to invade and go there and then never find them?
Well, of course, but that was a case where the Bush administration came into office wanting to invade and occupy Iraq, and they were looking for any excuse to do so. The Obama administration did not come into office desperate to have a fight with North Korea. So they have no compelling political goal in mind that they want to grab any piece of evidence they can to back it up. So this isn't the same at all. Bush administration came into office. They wanted to invade Iraq. They were just looking for a reason to do so. And they grabbed any evidence and distorted it to do that. And they lied to the American people and the world. In this case, Obama administration has no particular goal with North Korea. We'd all like to see the country overthrown and democracy flourish, but they have no desire to pick a battle with North Korea. So there is no compelling political goal that was already there in place that would make us say, oh, yeah, we know all along that that's all they've wanted to do is pick a fight with North Korea. They want to bomb them. Well, no, that's not true. They don't want to prod that beehive.
Well, two listeners who wrote in actually said, look, it may not be direct. It may not be that they have a beef with North Korea or that they're trying to gin something up, as you say, with North Korea, but maybe one of their allies, a la Russia and or China.
Allies? Russia?
and or China. No, I'm saying North Korea's allies.
Yeah. Yes. What about them?
That if North Korea should fall, if North Korea should kind of, if the
well, that's not on the table. We're not going to invade them.
No. I mean, just because, economically they just kind of collapse.
Are collapsed. They have been for a long time.
Yeah. Then both China and Russia would kind of be in a position where they have to kind of come to their aid. So.
Well, they're already, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, this is not a political show.
The Obama administration is not claiming North Korea attacked Sony because they want to create trouble for China.
Okay, so you're saying they don't want to gin up anything with North Korea or China. There's a lot of gin going around in this conversation.
Anyway, they had no compelling reason to do that. They're not playing, three-level chess here. It's like they believe they cyber attacked Sony or they don't. They either made a mistake and now they're doubling down because they're embarrassed, or they actually believe it's true and just aren't releasing the information. One guy's trying to defend them and he says, oh, Anyone with a keyboard can be an expert. This is James Lewis, a director and senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And he posted an essay defending the government. And he said, opinion substitutes for research. The uninformed debate over the Sony cyber incident is the most recent example of the internet's limitations. And I would say, no, it's an example of the internet's possibilities. It's not Joe Blow at a blogging in his underwear who says, I don't buy the information yet. It's experts who are weighing in, who are actual security experts with enough, you know, credibility behind them that the Obama administration even met with them. You know, that one company they met with and sat down with said, what do you got? These aren't just Joe Schmuck, you know, online yelling out on Fox News, I don't believe it. You know, these are actual experts who have a track record and who have legitimacy and who are spelling out what they believe and the facts and the evidence and why they would give examples of why this may not necessarily be so. You know, crowdsourcing a problem like that can actually be useful.
I agree. But you know who doesn't care whether it's North Korea, China, or anybody? You know?
Sony? What? Who?
Well, Charlize Theron and her representation.
Okay. What's that segue?
Well, that's to talk about this $10 million deal that she got when now this doesn't have anything to do directly with the hack other than the fact that in that hack, all these documents that were released and these emails that were released, it was discovered that a lot of the women, the female actors, the actresses, were not being paid as much as the actors.
Discovered? This isn't a secret.
Well, I would agree.
It was just ugly black and white. Like, look, even on a movie like American Hustle, where everybody seems to be on par with each other, suddenly you say, the men make more than the women, up and down the line, all the time. And it's sort of pushing it in your face yet again.
Yes, and in a way that was kind of indisputable, because it was right there.
Facts. And this points out the idea that we may not be going over all the evidence and all the documents that were released, but everybody in Hollywood is, aren't they? They're all looking at those contracts and details and specifics and writers and looking at that. And that's going to inform their business negotiations for years to come, isn't it?
Yeah. And even on some stuff that, you know, we'll never actually read about in the news or hear about on
that's what
website.
I'm saying,
because you know it's just not interesting enough, but it is interesting.
But it is to Hollywood.
Yeah, contractually it's really interesting.
And so what happened to Charlize Theron?
Well, she's going to be starring in this movie called, what is it, just The Huntsman? It's the prequel to Snow White and the Huntsman. Mm-hmm. And Chris Hemsworth is starring in it as well. And she said, you know what, pay me as much as you paid him, so make it equal.
And this is because of the Sony cyber attack?
Yeah, because she basically said, you know, none of this, you know, he gets more than me. And this is, again, page 6 of the New York Post. So for what it's worth, they credit, you know, anonymous sources, inside sources, quote, Charlize insisted that she get paid the same money as Chris. She has a great track record, so she got the same deal.
Mm-hmm. And then somebody else attributed it directly to Sony. They said one knock-on effect from the Sony hacking scandal is that there will be more sensitivity about equal pay for actresses and hiring practices at movie studios. So the movie Snow White and the Huntsman was a good hit. It starred Kristen Stewart from the Twilight movies and Chris Hemsworth and Charlize Theron. In this prequel, it's just Chris and Charlize. And she said, hey, pay me what you're paying him.
Right.
And apparently she got the deal, so good for her.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, ultimately, I'm sure the business affairs departments at all of these studios are looking at this and thinking it's kind of a big deal.
Ah, I know what you're doing.
Yeah, you keep pointing it out. Segues are supposed to be, you know, silent, right? Not silent, but...
Keep going.
Transparent?
Sure, keep going.
Okay, well, I was trying to move us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the FCC. You might recall them. We keep talking about them. Well, they are all but certain to back President Obama's call for strong net neutrality when regulating the internet and internet service providers.
We don't have like a cue for like applause.
Hey,
anything,
if I don't get a laugh track, you don't get applause. Okay, that's just the way. And by the way, that whole sentence, things I never thought I'd say. But most importantly, they're going to probably, definitely, maybe embrace what many tech activists have called for as the only reasonable justification for their regulation. While the FCC has bent over backwards to insist it has jurisdiction, until now it has avoided embracing the idea that Title II is what gives them that power. Now, here in the United States, Title II means that, you know, your communication lines have to be open and non-discriminatory.
So if you dial a phone number, it goes through.
It doesn't matter
whether you're calling a big company or your next door neighbor or whatever. You make a call, it works. If they call, big company calls you, it works. If you call somebody who doesn't a big company, it shouldn't take 35 seconds to connect.
Correct.
Same thing with the internet. Not hard to understand.
The head of the FCC also poo-pooed ideas he'd been bandying about before, like the much derided belief that companies could pay for special treatment of their traffic, say companies like Netflix. Lobbyists on both sides seem to be reading the tea leaves the same way. So this amounts to a sea change in how the internet will be overseen by the government, at least in the United States. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
That's a big whoop.
What?
I'm kidding. It's a big deal. It is. We'll have to see when it happens, goes into place, see how they actually move forward into putting into effect the new regulations. But it's potentially a very big deal, and it's the right step to make. It's the only logical step without twisting themselves into a pretzel and trying to justify what they do without actually embracing the obvious common sense reason why they have oversight for the internet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes. Everything you said. I mean, you did. I guess I look at some of these providers and say you didn't play nicely. So now, you know, parents are going to have to come in.
Punishing them. This is about just doing a level playing field for everybody, meaning everybody will benefit. They always think, oh, it's a new regulation. We're being punished. Oh, no, we've lost. The internet service providers have not lost. Netflix hasn't lost. The consumer has won. You know, a level playing field means everybody can participate equally. The rules are clear and fair. New young companies can spring up and become successful. Big companies need to remain nimble so their investors are happier, because they're not going to get lethargic and become dinosaurs and sclerotic and die. They'll hopefully remain on their toes. So it's not a punishment or a loss for anyone. It's just the way business should work. Clear and simple playing field, clear and simple rules, everybody benefits. Business always thinks they're being punished if there's a rule or a regulation, and they're just idiots and they don't know what's good for them.
Well, I'll take it one step further or add to what you just said. And I know there are some folks out there who believe that, well, if Title II is enacted here against the internet, then you know what? It's not going to – the investment will dry up for new startups.
Yeah, right.
I don't buy that for a second.
Of course not.
Yeah, so – but surely, this isn't the first podcast to be turned into a TV show, is it?
Ours? Well, are we a TV show now?
No, I've moved on to the next story.
Oh, okay.
In any case, superstar astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. I see what you did there, superstar astrophysicist. I get it. That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
He is bringing his very popular show, Star Talk, to the National Geographic Channel. It features comics and experts weighing in on science topics a la Bill Maher. Since it is already sort of a TV show, given that the podcast, it's available on streaming video, Tyson feels it's a low-risk bet for the channel. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, if it's the first podcast to become a TV show, is it?
I don't think so.
I couldn't think of another example.
Oh, you know what? What about the Mark Maron? Well, no, it wasn't the exact same show. WTF, the
people have made the leap from podcast to TV shows, just like what's his name, the geek guy, you know, the guy who does Talking Dead.
Chris something. Yeah, I know, he also does At Midnight.
That's right, At Midnight. I didn't know if he had a post, I didn't know if he had a podcast like At Midnight. Chris Hardwick.
I don't know
if he had a podcast like that, but yeah, he certainly made the leap. Other people have made the leap. I can't recall an actual podcast becoming an actual TV show, like literally that podcast, but this is certainly one of the first examples, maybe. And it's certainly, of course, it's not a person who grew up in a podcast. He's well-known outside of his podcast. In fact, he brought his fame to the podcast, but it's a cool thing. We'll have to see if it's good. I've never listened to it or watched it online. But you know what? The fact that it's made it to this new platform gets me more interested to say, hey, maybe I should check it out.
Yes, although his producer is saying they're having a bit of a trouble booking stars.
Oh, God. has anybody wanted to turn Serial into a TV show?
I'm sure somebody does.
Yeah. All right. Keep going.
You know, everything old is new again. We talk
except us.
Apparently.
We just get older and older.
And more tangential. Maybe that's actually saying something about
tangential?
Our own...
Tangential? Is that what you're saying?
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Hey, this is a family show. I don't know what you just said there.
I'm just trying to say the word right.
Oh, okay. We talked last week about the continued vitality of the vinyl LP format as a niche medium for music lovers. Its sales seem all the more impressive since CD and digital sales are at such historic lows, though the numbers are a far cry from their heyday. Clearly, people are collecting vinyl LPs again. But with the new world we live in, this fancy for the old-fashioned format, see what we did there? Fancy, okay. Has a new twist. Netflix! Okay, not actually Netflix, but a company called Vinyl, and that's vinyl without the I. They are offering LPs in the same way that Netflix offers DVDs. You pay a monthly fee, and you can receive LPs in the mail. Mail them back when you're done, and they'll send along the next ones. As of yet, you don't get to make lists of which albums you'd like to hear when available. Instead, the company will surprise you with their picks for music, and they will kind of fit that to a particular mood that you choose, all for $15 a month. If you keep the LP, you'll pay $8 to $12. And somehow, you'll all wind up back in 1962. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I don't know if there were there LPs in 62.
I don't know. I was just, you know, it's like the Columbia House record deal here.
Well, yeah, I think it's odd. I mean, I guess they didn't want to buy 10,000 copies of Sgt. Pepper. So they don't want you to choose the actual albums you're going to listen to. So to me, it seems a little less of interest than it would be if it was an actual Netflix type offering where I'm sure new albums they couldn't do. They probably wouldn't be allowed to. I don't know about fair use, but that might be an issue. But I don't know why, because unlike CDs, you're not really copying LPs. So, you know, if you wanted to hear a new album and listen to it and then send it back, who loses? Nobody.
But part of the whole problem with LPs, not a problem, but one of the issues with mailing LPs was that they were bigger, they were bulkier, they were more cumbersome, they could break easier. And that's why compact discs with supposedly better sound.
Well, they were portable. You could put them in your car, you know.
Yeah. So now you're going to a more cumbersome format. Okay.
Well, the LPs came out in 1948. So, yes, they were available long before 1962.
I don't know. Oh, you're going back to the question. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, John Travolta, remember him?
Talk about everything old being new again. John Travolta's on TV.
Yes, indeed. He is tackling his first TV role since Welcome Back, Cotta. Did I say that right?
You did. Mr. Cotta.
Yeah, that was back in the late 1970s.
God, I'm old.
While still on the show, he burst into superstardom with Saturday Night Fever in 1977 and then Grease in 1978. Welcome Back, Cotta ended in 1979, and Travolta never looked back. Now he's jumping onto the limited series bandwagon by signing on to play lawyer Robert Shapiro in the O.J. Simpson 10-part miniseries American Crime Story from creator Ryan Murphy. Travolta will
also...
You hate
American Horror Story? Do you hate...
Just the O.J. Simpson story.
Oh.
Yeah, Travolta will also produce. He joins Cuba Gooding Jr., as O.J. Simpson, David Schwimmer as Robert Kardashian, and me, J. Sperling Reich, as the forgetful house guest, Cato Kalin. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think it's a big deal that the fact that Travolta got this deal sounds like the most exciting thing that's happened for him in a few years. Hey. I mean, that's not a slur on him. That's a positive about limited series until, you know, they're making news about who they cast in the new season of True Detective. Travolta makes news when he's going to be in the new, you know, that's more exciting than about any movie he could have named. You know, yeah. I think that's where all the quality work is being done right now. There's just no question about it. We've known it for years, that TV, but it just reinforces that fact. But boy, Welcome Back, Cotter was a bad show.
Well, you know, you talked about the mixed kind of reviews of, we didn't get ratings yet, I don't think, but the mixed reviews that the Golden Globes got at the very beginning, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, the hosts, said, you know, when I say movies, you say awesome movies. And then everybody in the crowd yelled awesome. And then they said, when I say TV, you say better TV. And everybody yelled better. And then they proceeded in the next breath to kind of put TV down. By saying, you know, we'll get to some movie awards, and if we have time, we'll do some TV awards too.
Okay.
Yeah, so I agree with you, though. I think TV, you know, we're seeing a lot more risk-taking in television and better work, frankly.
Yeah.
Now, Alibaba, the Amazon of China, which would prefer to be known as the world's biggest entertainment company, is pushing into movies. We've talked about that before. Their first big project has Wong Kar-wai as a producer, actor Tony Leung as star, and hip novelist Zhang Zhaizhai as writer and director. Roughly translated as ferryman, the movie is based on a short story about those tasked with helping people get to, quote-unquote, the other side. The head of the studio division, sounding like studio executives everywhere, said simply, "We want to make films that people like." Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. We knew this was coming. I think it's just the first of many. It's not a wildly exciting project. It's, you know, it's big names. Of course it is. So, you know, we'll have to see how it works out. We'll have to see how successful they become about creating content, because that's not so easy. You know, it seems like everybody can do it now, but, you know, they had trouble with the Halo movie from Xbox, and it's not easy to become something that's very, very different from what you do. So full credit to Netflix and Amazon for making that leap. We'll have to see how good Alibaba becomes at it. I'm sure ultimately, if they're patient and pay the money and get the right people, it'll work. But, you know, first things first.
You know, we should have led with this next story right after our Charlize Theron piece, you know, because of Michael or I. We're hoping to break into TV as a director? Well, guess what? We've already got one big advantage over our competition. We're white males. That may not help us win a passport to Shondaland, but for most of TV, it's exactly what you can expect, sadly enough. According to a new survey conducted by the DGA, women made up only 18% of first-time directors, while minorities made up only 13% of the same. Better yet, for Michael and I, some 28% had made the leap from writer to director. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal, but perhaps in a positive way. Because, I don't know, but if you look at movies and you look at first-time directors who had a film released theatrically, I don't know if you'd hit 18% in women.
That's true.
And
then,
and perhaps it's true that women are actually making more inroads. I'm hoping this is a sign of a positive growth. So maybe I'm in fantasy land, and of course it should be higher for women and minorities because they're the majority of the population when you add them all up. But, you know, hey, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe almost one out of five new directors is a woman. That's a hell of a lot better than movies. And let's hope it continues to get better.
Well,
certainly when you look at Shonda Rhimes, it should be better.
Well, speaking of which, according to the map I have here, if you are in fantasy land, it's right next door to Shondaland.
It's probably on your block because everybody lives on your block. So it's probably Shondaland is right down the street from you, I imagine.
With a big sign.
That's right.
Now, many major news organizations were deciding to cover the terrorist attack against French cartoonists without showing the actual cartoons that had lampooned the Prophet Muhammad and stirred up anger and ultimately the bloody rampage. We're going to show them right here, as you can see. I'm holding them up. We're not afraid. CNN, the New York Daily News.
Je suis Don Knotts.
Exactly. Now we'll have to explain who that is. The Associated Press and many others had at least for a time consciously chosen to cover the story without displaying the imagery or making it available on their websites. Fox News showed the cartoons on its website, at least, as did others. Some decried the censorship and said the terrorists had won. Cartoonist Art Spiegelman was among those calling major U.S. newspapers out as hypocritical for refusing to publish none of the images at issue. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. I think it is an important thing to point out. Hey, you're talking about, oh, these people were angered by this thing, but we won't show it to you. You know, there were some images of where the Prophet Muhammad was naked, and most newspapers aren't going to show naked pictures, even of cartoons. And so, okay, you wouldn't show those necessarily, but not to show any? That seemed odd. Of course, they're offensive. Of course, they have anti-Semitic cartoons. They have caricatures of Jews and Charlie Hebdo. So, you know, yes, of course, there's things that are offensive to anybody. But, you know, if you're going to talk about this international incident that has captured the attention of the world, it seems like at the very least you could say, hey, here it is on our website if you wish to view it. What, you know, show us what you're talking about. It's not like pornography. It's not like child porn where, you know, nobody wants to see it. It's obnoxious satire and humor, and to not show it at all. But you know what's bizarre to me is that everybody talked about how they weren't showing these cartoons, but nobody talked about how everybody was posting this video of a gun battle on the street where you watch a policeman be killed. You know, they're shooting the guy in the head. And my brother was, I'm like, why are you watching that? I don't want to see that. I don't need that image in my head. You know, and maybe you don't want to see the images of the cartoons, and that's fine. Choose not to watch it. But it's funny that nobody had a problem with, like, showing a man being slaughtered on the street and everybody's clicking on the video. Oh, look at that. Oh, that's terrible. And meanwhile, the cartoons is the thing that people are hedging away from. But not one outlet said, oh, we better not show that video. It was on every damn outlet in the world. And so it's a bizarre double standard, I think. The actual thing that's at issue versus watching a man being killed. And they don't hesitate to show the man being killed.
Well, and that's twice in 1 week, because after the standoff on Friday.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they basically were across
the street.
Well, that's
what I was referring to, the one on Friday where they shot the cop who was lying on the street, who his family isn't talking about it. They wish to remain private, but many people are assuming because of his name that he is, in fact, Muslim. So all credit to him, a French man, a Muslim, helping to defend people, just like the guy in the grocery store who's Muslim, who was helping to save people and went out to the cops and gave them information that helped them keep those people safe when they were storming the place. So, you know, those are the people you should celebrate and talk about. And instead, they're showing him being assassinated, or not assassinated, but slaughtered on video. And nobody thought twice.
I'm talking about the person who did take over the grocery store, who then ran out and was shot live on television.
Well, that's different. You know, it's a live television thing. And then, of course, they probably showed it every minute on the hour, every hour for the next day, right?
Precisely. That's why. I mean, yeah. I guess.
We'll watch Slaughter, but don't show us a cartoon that somebody found offensive.
Well, and that's really it.
Or allow people the option. Perhaps that's the way I should put it.
Yeah, I guess the question is it okay to be offensive? That was one of the questions asked.
But you're a news organization. You're not trying to be offensive. You're saying
I'm talking about the cartoons in general. It's one thing to...
Well, of course you can be offensive. That's a free country you live in. Don't buy Charlie Hebdo if you don't want to look at him. Of course they can be offensive. That's the whole point of a free society. You have obnoxious people on the fringe who say and do things most people find hateful. You have free speech for the KKK. You're not going to have free speech for Charlie Hebdo?
No, I'm not saying you shouldn't. I guess that I'm just pointing out some of the arguments that came up last
week. Those are stupid arguments. Maybe they should be more careful when they're talking about these things and taunting people who are known for violence. No. That's the job of obnoxious satirists on the fringe of society. It's their job to infuriate and anger people. The response is not to kill them.
Well, what I would say to whoever is behind this attack, congratulations.
What do you mean, whoever? We know who they are. They're dead.
Well,
we don't know if there was a mastermind.
Right.
They act independently, perhaps. Yeah. One guy said he was, you know, supported ISIS.
And then they took, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and then Al-Qaeda in Yemen took responsibility for it.
They posted a video today or yesterday of one of the attackers who was championing ISIS.
Oh.
It was one of the attackers, a video posted 2 days after he died.
Well, my question is this. Had you ever heard of Charlie Hebdo before?
Well, they had. Yes, because firebombed the office. Yeah, they firebombed the office a couple years ago.
Okay, well... I don't necessarily know that the world had seen these cartoons and comics beforehand. I don't know that the world necessarily knew a lot about Charlie Hebdo beforehand, and now they certainly do. So if you were looking to squelch something, you did the exact opposite.
Well, not with the assist of the media, which refuses to show the things that they were offended by. Out of fear. What other reason is there? Nothing.
Well, let me ask you this, Michael, on a change of
subject. Speaking about violence and sex.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, guess what? You know, as you know, Michael, here in the U.S., it is a truism that Americans are kind of much more squeamish about sex than violence. Apparently, a little spanky-spanky in your film is good enough to trick the MPAA to thinking of it more as a violence than erotica. How else to explain the fact that the MPAA has given the new movie 50 Shades of Grey a rating? And it's an R. Either the movie is much tamer than the books, or the MPAA is much more comfortable with a red room of pain than, say, a boudoir. See, see how we tied these stories together with the use of a French word?
Oui.
Okay. On a hilarious note, they said the movie received an R rating for, and this is a quote, unusual behavior. Tell it to Anastasia Steele, fellows. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course, unless it means the movie is so denatured that fans will be disappointed. But it gives a whole new meaning to the idea of Blu-ray, doesn't it? Because believe me, there will be an unrated version coming out on Blu-ray a few weeks after the movie has stopped running in theaters.
That is true. The uncut version. The director's cut of the director's
cut. Well, I don't know that about the actor, but I don't think that's really important. But anyway, moving on.
Oh, my God. Hey, wait. Again, family show.
not this week.
You know, now you're going to have to go to every listener's family and okay, never mind. We were confused by talk show host Craig Ferguson's departure from late night for several reasons. You might recall.
Because he's so good.
Yeah. He swore up and down it was his own choice and he felt the show had kind of run its course. Okay, fine. We believed him. But we were confused when he soon afterwards announced he'd be doing another talk show in syndication for early access. Now, Access, that's the time period owned by the likes of Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy here in the United States before the major networks begin their primetime shows. Isn't that what he just said he'd grown tired of, talk shows? And how do you do a talk show in the early evening? Daytime talk? Okay, yes, we get it. Late night talk? Of course, it's where it kind of started, right? But early evening talk? It was odd. Apparently, TV stations agreed because the show's backers couldn't get enough clearance, otherwise known to non-industry folks as interest, to go forward. So Craigie Ferg's new talk show is kaput. On the bright side, his game show, Celebrity Game Night, has been renewed for a second season. And his movie, How to Train Your Dragon 2, it just won a Golden Globe. Shockingly. Big deal or big whoop?
Yes, that was a bit of an upset. I would say it's a big whoop, of course, a show that never happened. But hopefully he'll do some other projects that will be good. It was such an odd idea. I kind of wish I got to see it. But we will get to see Stephen Colbert, or do we call him Colbert now? I don't know. Is he still Colbert? His new show, they've given a date. It debuts on Tuesday, September 8th. So it's like 8 months away, but by God, it'll be coming. So he'll be there for Letterman in the fall.
Looking forward to it. But that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. These stories, they kind of all jumble together, but really, they're all about how established artists are reaching out and bringing their work directly to fans. And maybe, or maybe not, we don't know, profiting more by doing so rather than going through traditional distribution channels.
Okay, the first one is the one that's a little confusing because that's Tom York. Let's skip to David Cross and do him first.
Okay, David Cross, you might recall from Arrested Development. He's, you know, in
Arrested Development.
Yeah, good job there. He's also starred in, I want to say, The Chipmunks, right? Wasn't he the manager of The Chipmunks?
What's his name was?
Alvin and the Chipmunks, or?
Well, but I mean, the guy from Everybody.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
The skateboarder.
Yeah, Jay.
He was the father, and David Cross was the father.
The owner?
Not the owner. That's offensive.
Anyway,
Jason Lee.
Thank
and
you.
David Cross was the manager. Yes. Okay. Yes.
He.
Referencing something you don't know the name of is not really a great way to identify someone.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind.
David Cross, actor, Arrested Development. It's got a movie. Keep going.
Well, he had this movie that was in Sundance last year called Hits. And he got a few offers for it afterwards. And he said, you know what? None of the offers are good enough. I'm going to see about bringing it to fans directly on a pay what you want model. So, you know, it'll be video on demand. You pay what you want. He also wants to bring it to movie theaters that way on a, you know, buy a movie ticket for whatever you want to buy the movie ticket for.
So you mean he's going to four-wall a theater? That means he'll rent out a theater, and then people will fill it up with tickets? Or like if enough people buy a ticket, then they will then rent a theater for a screening time? Is that the idea?
I think so, because he has this Kickstarter campaign.
Okay.
In which he will, for $100,000, if he gets there, and I guess right now he's just above $36,000, and he's going to release it, I guess, in movie theaters. I don't know how he's going to do that, but I can only imagine the only way to do that is four-walling it.
Or unless it's one of those weekend streaming things.
Yeah, maybe.
And of course, he also is making it available on BitTorrent.
Yes. Oh, okay. So
how is that working?
Well,
it's like a bundle, right? It's pay what you want on BitTorrent. So you can download the movie and then you can decide what you want to pay. You get to see half the movie, or what's the deal?
I have no idea. I think you pay for the bundle up front, but you pay what you want for the bundle.
Okay.
Which is actually how In Rainbows was released. This is the Radiohead album back in 2007.
They didn't do it via BitTorrent.
They didn't do it via BitTorrent. They did a pay what you want model.
Yes, they did, but not via BitTorrent.
No. But now Tom York said, well, you know, I'm not going to do that again, but I will release some music.
He is doing that again.
He did. Well, no. You had to, it was $6 for his six songs.
No. Jesus Christ, why are you making this so complicated? No, what do you mean? He said, Tom, they did it within Rainbows, and now he's doing it again with his solo album. He said, well, he's not going to do that again, except he did do that again.
He's doing a BitTorrent bundle this time.
Right, which you can download for free.
And no, you can only download one song for free.
That's part of it for free. Well, you can download more than one song, but yeah, right. And if you want to pay for it, you can pay for it, right?
Right, but it's not pay what you want.
Okay, okay.
That's what
that is not the important thing.
Okay, well, all right. So what's the important
he's
thing?
He's re-releasing an album. He's releasing a solo album directly to fans. He's using BitTorrent for the first time, and millions of people downloaded it.
4.4 million people.
If you wanted full access to it, you could pay $6.
Right. That's the important part. Now we've got the story out there. We are just horrible today, aren't we?
We?
Oui? Oh. I thought you were speaking French there. Yes, we are. in any case.
What was annoying about this story, now that we've completely confused it, is that some stupid website, what was it, GigaOm, had a headline
saying, first of all, that's not a stupid website. That's a good website.
Tom York made as much as $20 million from his BitTorrent thing.
Except
because they said,
maybe not.
Well, 4.4 million people downloaded the free bundle. And they could have, if they wanted to, paid $6 and get access to the full album. So if they all did, he would have made $20 million. Except, of course, they all didn't. We have no idea how many did, but we're almost certain it wasn't all of them. And Billboard magazine weighed in and said, yeah, you know what? That's pretty stupid. If you look at the actual numbers and compare it to like Pandora, who pays for, you know, paid Pandora versus a free service? Well, that's maybe 5% of the people pay for the full service. So if you figure 5% of the people who downloaded the album actually paid the $6 to get the full thing, then he would have made $2 million, which is no small pennies.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So we don't know how many people paid for access to the full album. We do know 4.4 million people downloaded the free bundle where they could then access more if they paid money. So he's experimenting. He probably made $1 million or $2 on it. Great. And he did it directly to people. And maybe he's happy with it. It's a small experimental album. It's not like a Radiohead album. It's more like a soundtrack type release.
Exactly.
You know, it's a little more experimental. So if he made $2 million and had very low costs, he may be thrilled with the results. If maybe someday he'll tell us what he actually made and how it worked and how many people bought it, that would be interesting. But we don't know.
It would be interesting and might have tax implications for him, so he probably won't.
No, he doesn't get to lie to the IRS about what he or whoever he needs to file for. He doesn't get to lie about what his income is.
Well,
the
you
fact
know
that he doesn't report it to the media doesn't mean he gets to lie to the government.
Just in case, I'm going to contact North Korea and see if they can find out for us.
Right. So what did PJ Harvey do?
Well, you
talking
about
another artist.
Yeah, talking about experimenting. She actually said, all right, you know what? I'm cutting this new album. I'm going to sell 3,000 tickets for $22 each. And you can come in, I think, two or three people per day or something like that. You can come in and watch me record this next album.
Oh, they physically come into the studio.
No, I think they do it via, you know, online, basically.
Well, I don't know. You're talking about tickets. I know that. There were 4 tickets per household. Well, that's what I wasn't clear about, whether you were just streaming your own personal window. And if so, why did she limit to 3,000 people? So I think she actually had people in the studio. I'm just guessing now, but maybe that's what it was.
I don't know.
Why would you limit to 3,000 people? It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't say whether it's online or in person, but I would imagine it's online.
I don't know what city she's in or where she's recording, but if it's online, I don't know why she limited to 3,000. Why not say $5 and everybody can watch? I mean, people have allowed streaming into their web. Great. We've had 3 articles and 2 of them, we have no idea what's going on. Well done.
Well, no, wait a second.
You posted them. You should have learned out what they were.
Well, wait a second. The reason I thought it was online, and there's a good reason, because this story, which comes from Hypebot.
It says that the servers broke down, but that was in the demand for
tickets. No. At the very end, it says, of course, it will be interesting to see the reviews after fans have to watch a couple of hours of the same part.
You can watch when you're sitting in a studio. It's not clear.
Let me finish. The same part being played over and over, or the engineer doing a tedious Pro Tools vocal comp or edit, they may decide it's not exactly must-see TV. Thus the reason. I thought it was online.
Well, that's weird. Okay, 3,000 tickets. I guess you just wanted exclusivity. Anyway, the idea that fans would be bored by it, I think is wrong. I think, actually, watching the recording process when you've never seen it before is fascinating. And you're doing it for 2 hours, it's neat. I went and watched somebody recording an album, Teddy Thompson. I was there for a couple hours. I was like, oh, I know you're bored. I'm like, no, it's all interesting. I've never seen it before. You know, you're on a movie set. It's boring if you're there for 3 months. If you've never been on a set before, I don't care if they're rigging lighting for 2 hours. It's neat.
Yeah.
So I think it was probably successful. Fans thought it was cool. And, you know, they got a glimpse of the recording process.
I mean, well, they will have a glimpse of the recording process.
Well, and it's not just, so that's two musicians and a movie guy, but it's not just them who are doing this Kickstarter campaign stuff where you're trying to reach out to fans and find new ways to get your stuff to them or to involve them in the making of it, like PJ Harvey's doing. You know, she's sort of subsidizing her recording process by letting people glimpse in and watch what she's recording. Same thing's been happening in publishing. There's a lot of self-publishing projects that have raised money on Kickstarter. This year, $22 million was raised for successful self-publishing projects. That means money that was, you know, they've met their goal and people actually paid the money. So that's about 2,000 successful campaigns out of 7,000 proposed ones. So one out of three worked and actually reached its goal and made it happen. Comic books are a big area. They raised almost $10 million to publish comic books. People would say, hey, here's the new comic book project I want to do. Join me on Kickstarter, and people funded money. Now, I assume most of these are like where you get to get a copy of the final book, or you get a piece of artwork, or they give you something to make you feel worthwhile and chipping in to make it happen. In other cases, maybe it's just saying, yeah, I love you. I love your work. I want to see it happen.
Yeah, and I've done both. I've done the one where you actually get a copy of the book. I've also done one where, let's face it, I was pretty much just supporting.
Like Veronica Mars. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Like Veronica Mars was one. I didn't support that necessarily, but, you know, there have been some books and there was one, a playwright who was putting together a workshop and wanted to workshop something. And so I basically donated money. I got, I think, a signed page of the script.
Cool.
And it came in the mail and I was like, what is this? And I went, oh, yeah, that's, you know, but I had no idea what it was. I felt like I had won a class action lawsuit.
Well, when they're smart, they offer some unique, fun things as incentives. Like David Cross said, I'll be a godfather to your child if you give me, I think it was like $1,000 or something.
It was $7,500. However, he did say, as part of that, he has no legal obligation to do anything more than be godfather in name only. There is no obligations to attend services, provide advice, or actually ever talk or meet your child. So
that's very funny. And so because there's money to be made, more and more artists are using campaigns like this to get their music out to people or their creative content or just to make it happen in the first place. So Amazon is stepping in.
Yes. Well, they're stepping in trying to create their own platform.
Right. They want to create a crowdfunding platform, but they're saying, hey, we're soup to nuts here. You come here, you raise money, you make the project happen, and then you sell it here. It's like, we'll be there from beginning to end. We'll make it as easy as possible for you. And they've been sponsoring stuff and getting involved in this. But now they're really doing a lot of hires to try and clearly step up this area and create a new platform because they, of course, want to do everything.
Yes, including build phones, which if you read Fast Company, they didn't do a very good job of.
Well, you don't need to read Fast Company. Everybody knows they didn't do a good job.
Right. But that kind of wraps up Inside Baseball this week.
The worst Inside Baseball ever.
You know, you say that every week. But,
do I?
No, I'm just, I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
I'm not that cranky, Pants.
Oh, for that reference, go back a few episodes. Okay, but that, unfortunately, for 3 weeks, we have not covered obituaries, which doesn't necessarily mean people haven't left us. It just means we haven't covered them. And so this week, we're going to try and catch up.
Well, we're not going to list everybody. Well, no. You know, there's no point. But like, you know, sometimes we feel like we focus too much on the big names. And it's fun when somebody in an area that doesn't get a lot of attention can be highlighted, like Sandy Reisenbach. He's a one-time Warner Brothers marketing exec. He died at 82. And he was a big player in some of their campaigns over the years, like their franchises for Batman and Lethal Weapon and Police Academy and the movie Private Benjamin. And what I remember well is he was a big key part of the Oscar-winning campaign for Chariots of Fire, which was a great campaign to turn a tiny British movie into a box office hit.
Also passing away just recently was Taylor Negron, a comic and actor. He starred in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and he's one of those actors where, Michael, before the show, we were looking him up, and you saw a picture of him, and you went, oh, yeah, that guy.
Right, which is kind of the heart of Hollywood, isn't it? I mean, that's the blood of Hollywood. You know, those people who are there, they work, they have a living, you kind of recognize them. They may not be big stars, but, you know, hey, if he's got a career where we can recognize him, that's pretty great.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's people that everybody knows, like Donna Douglas. She played Ellie Mae on the Beverly Hillbillies. And Anita Ekberg, who became famous forever in that scene in La Dolce Vita. You know, they're beauties, and they were in iconic TV shows or movies and are known forever. You know, everybody recognizes them the second they see them.
Right. I think everybody would. Well, I don't know. Do you think anybody would recognize Louise Rainer?
No, Reiner. But Reiner, I think more to the point was like, she's still alive?
Yes.
She was 104, and she's the first person to win back-to-back Oscars. She won for The Great Ziegfeld and The Good Earth. So she is a classic answer to a trivia question. And there's only four people who've done it in history. Louise Rainer, Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, and of course, Tom Hanks. So that does not happen very often at all. She was married and divorced to Clifford Odets. You know, the firebrand playwright, and he was jealous because Albert Einstein had a crush on her. The things you read about when you read obits for these famous classic Hollywood people. She defied the studio system and left MGM before she was 30, and her career essentially ended. But what I love about Louise Rainer is that I saw The Good Earth, based on the Pearl S. Buck novel, long ago when I was a kid. She was in yellowface, of course, playing a Chinese person. But I saw this movie with my mom as a kid. I liked it because after the movie, I always got to refer to my mom as old woman. Because In the movie, they'd say, old woman, old man. And it was a term of respect. And I'd say, well, good morning, old woman. And she's like, don't say that. I'm like, I'm being respectful.
Yeah, that said, you were never taken to the movies again.
That's true. I had to stay home and watch TV like real people.
Oh, okay. So which one?
That's reality TV show producer Howard Schultz. He died at 61, a behind-the-scenes guy that people in the industry would know, but we didn't necessarily. But he did Studs, I think is the most notable thing he did. This was a late-night syndicated show, a dating show, but they really pushed the envelope on the allusions to sex and things that they made on the show. They really were pretty daring and kind of raised or lowered the bar, depending on your point of view.
Also, Edward Herman, an actor, died at the age of 71. Now, Michael, you actually had an interesting, you found his career interesting.
Well, you know, I loved him. I know him best from Gilmore Girls. That's the TV show where he played the patriarch Richard Gilmore with Kelly Bishop from A Chorus Line as his wife. They were great characters, criminally overlooked by the Emmy Awards. It's just bizarre that they didn't recognize him. But he had a great career, TV, stage, film, Paper Chase, Purple Rose of Cairo, Reds, all the way up to The Wolf of Wall Street. He was in that movie. He was on The Good Wife. He had a good arc on that show. He always played blue buds. And forever throughout his career, since the 70s, he's been identified with Franklin Delano Roosevelt because he starred in a TV movie in 1976 called Eleanor and Franklin. Jane Alexander played Eleanor, and it was a smash hit, and he got an Emmy nomination, and that was a great year for him, because in that same year, he was on Broadway in a revival of Shaw's Mrs. Warren's Profession. So he played FDR then, and then all the way at the end of his career, in the new Ken Burns documentary, he played FDR in that one. He did the voiceover work, doing the voice of FDR when you would read letters and stuff, like you would in that classic Ken Burns style. So, you know, he played him for decades. He was associated with FDR. And of course, he did like a gazillion documentaries and voiceover work for ads and TV shows and audiobooks and stuff like that. So a very interesting actor and, you know, a nice, long, distinguished career. And he got to wear a lot of tuxes because he always played wealthy, big business type people.
Also passing away, Andre Crouch.
Yes.
He's a gospel singer.
That's right. Soon and Very Soon is one of his big hits.
Yeah.
He worked with Michael Jackson and Madonna. And it's kind of funny because some people like Ray Charles took gospel music and brought it into pop. And he kind of created rhythm and blues, bringing that sound of the gospel, but singing about love and romance. It was very scandalous. People were offended that you would use the sounds of gospel music to tell songs about love and romance. And then now people like Andre Crouch brought it back again. He took the sounds of soul and pop and R&B and brought it back into gospel to funk it up again. And people would say, no, keep that out of gospel music. You know, first gospel music crossed over to pop, and then when it crossed back, they got upset again. And he said, look, there's a lot of boring songs about Jesus. You want to put people to sleep, go right ahead, but I want to wake them up and have them enjoy themselves and remember what I'm saying. So, you know, he's an interesting, fascinating talent.
Which is why Billy Bob Thornton's speech last night when he won for best whatever for Fargo.
He was on Fargo, yeah.
Yeah. And he said, you know, you can get in trouble for anything, for saying anything. If you say it, you get in trouble. If you don't say it, you get in trouble. So I'm just going to say thank you. And he walked off.
What does that have to do with Andre Crouch?
Well, you know, if you're singing about it, when it crosses over, and then when it comes back, no, we don't want it that much, you know. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And literally, in gospel music, literally.
And finally, there's Samuel Goldwyn Jr., who I'm sorry to say did not get to make a final project that I was hoping for. He's one of those few people in Hollywood who escaped the shadow of their parent, you know, their famous big parent. It's really hard to do. And it happens, you know, Angelica Houston, Sofia Coppola. I'm sure there's lots of other examples. But more often than not, people remain in the shadow of a really big person. And it's hard to escape that. But he did it. You know, his dad was, of course, part of MGM. And he had a great career as an independent producer and gave a lot of people their start, like Julia Roberts and Kenneth Branagh and Anthony Minghella, at least in the movies. And, you know, he's the father of Tony Goldwyn, who's a fine director and actor himself. But what I love about Samuel Goldwyn Jr., he's got a classic Hollywood childhood. His parents did not seem to be too wildly involved in his life. You know, it's like, he seems kind of cold and indifferent, but he became a great guy, did a lot of great work. And as a kid, he delivered newspapers, you know, classic childhood, you know, job. You wake up early in the morning and you roll up the newspapers and you throw them onto the porches of the neighborhood, or in this case in Beverly Hills, I guess, onto the estates of right. Beverly Hills. And he delivered newspapers from his dad's chauffeured limo. It rolled down the window in the back and he's tossing out papers left and right. Like, oh, good morning, Sammy. You know, it's just that doesn't get more Hollywood than that.
That is true.
But one of his last great projects was Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, a great movie starring Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany. Terrific movie, lots of Oscar nominations. It was successful, but not big successful enough to inspire sequels because it's based on a series of books by Patrick O'Brien. There's 21 of them. They only made one movie. And I wish to God Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany could make that thing happen and get another movie in the works, because it was a great movie. They were great in those roles. And I'm sure Samuel Goldwyn Jr. would love to know that that series continued.
I agree. And the well worth reading the books as well.
Oh, they're great. Yeah.
Yeah. But that concludes our show for today. Again, if you'd like to write to us and tell us how off base we were or how much you loved us, you can do so. Dirt@showbizsandbox is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or wherever they give podcasts away for free. That's usually where you can find us. We do urge you to rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as all those ways to follow us and like us and subscribe to us and contact us, all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's a little different. What is it this week, Michael?
Je suis Charlize Theron.
Ooh, I like that. That's actually pretty good. I would imagine it's a .com and a not a .gov or a .ed.
Oui.
Okay. However, if you have a bit of an issue finding Michael's writing about the entertainment industry there, why not try michaelgiltz.com or head on over to the Huffington Post or bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.